My name is Willie. Angst and discomfort of my childhood led me to a life of drugs, alcohol, and crime. Today I work to stay sober, know myself well, and connect with a power greater than myself that I have historically struggled to understand.
I'm Cameron. Curveballs that life had thrown me had me seeking relief through substances. Today, I'm learning that sobriety is just the beginning. Self-love is a learned behavior, and that we never stop surrendering.
Listen to the stories of those who have been where you're at.
Our desire is that you'll hear something that will give you hope and help you to see that on the other side of pain is joy.
And on the other side of hell is peace.
Hi, I'm Cameron.
And I'm Willie.
Welcome to the Other Side of Hell
podcast.
Hi, Willie.
Cameron.
How are you, sir?
I'm good.
It has been a minute.
Yeah, it feels like it's been a long time.
How does it feel to have these headphones on?
Yeah, I'm nervous. I'm good, though.
Yeah.
I got a lot running through my head right now about, you know, service work and being able to perform. I got a little performance anxiety and, you know, just a lot's happened in between the last time we were in studio and this time we're in studio. And I'm excited to talk about it, get the therapeutic value of one alcoholic talking to another and bringing in.
Yeah, yeah. I think one thing we maybe didn't realize is how much we were benefiting from doing the show, right?
I think so.
At some point, it felt like it had become a chore.
Yeah.
And I think that recovery can feel like that.
Yeah, for sure.
And begin to feel...
all the time.
Yeah, overwhelming. Like, what, we got to do this forever?
Yeah.
Well, as long as we want to stay sober.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think... It's great to be here. I think it's appropriate that for our first show back in our new studio, that we have a really amazing story from somebody that you know, our fans might recognize. We got Dave from the Dopey Podcast here.
Yeah.
And he shared his war story with us and we're gonna share it with everybody.
Yeah.
And I can't wait from that. The topic that we were able to pull from that was identifying with the disease.
Yeah.
What do you think of when I talk about like identifying with the disease?
Well, you know, and we'll get to it, but in Dave's story, he talked a lot about wanting to have a certain image around the drug and alcohol world, right? Like wanting to be a certain type of person. And I could definitely identify with that because I always wanted to be something other than me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I never felt like I quite matched up to what everybody else seemed to match up to, you know. It seemed like everybody else was always okay with their own image. Right. Like
it seemed like that.
Yeah. Like it seemed like everybody else in my life was always pretty solid on they all seemed like
they were
and who they were.
Yeah.
Right. And I was always like this square peg in a round hole kind of feeling, even around really good friends, you know, people that I consider friends and lifelong friends, you know, get older, get a little bit more experience, come to find out that we're all kind of fucking uncomfortable in our skin.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, but this is like classic alcoholic thinking, right? Is like, we're different. We're separate from nobody else is like us. We're not like anybody else. And we're the only ones feeling this way.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to get wrapped up in that thinking.
Yeah. Well, the disease wants us unique, right?
Right.
Wants us feeling apart from everybody else. Like you're fucking special.
Yeah. It wants us to feel separate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think in Dave's story, like what he's talking about, is, you know, being inspired by some of these, you know, poets and musicians and things that had certain habits or traits. And I think really in my mind, like it becomes a way to sort of justify it. Like I found something that makes me feel good. And it turns out that these people that I look up to also kind of, you know, had that as a part of their life or part of their experience. So, hey man, like I want to be like them. Like I'm one of those people, you know.
Did you have any people like that or any like, you know, idols or You know, like for me, when I was a teenager, certain rap groups were a great big fucking part of it. Like I really wanted that gangster image.
You want to be NWA?
Yeah. Okay. Smoking weed and pimping bitches, you know, like that whole, and then fighting and heavy metal, like was a big part of it too. Like, you know, I wanted, but my body type wasn't conducive with that, right? Like when I was a white kid from Wyoming. So even then, like I always felt like a phony. Like I'd walking around with my pants sagging, listening to, like you say, NWA or something like that, and knowing that that's not the reality of who I am, or wanting to be a headbanger and I couldn't grow my hair long, and the drugs just seemed to ease that anyway,
right? And makes you don't care
into it.
Yeah. I never really had that actually. Like which for me feels like, because I was never really trying to base my usage on the image of somebody that I looked up to, like I was immediately like hit with guilt and shame, right? Like this is so far away from, you know, the kind of person that I maybe want to be, that it seems like, why am I doing this? You know, like how come this is, 'cause I didn't start, you know, like we've talked about this, like I didn't start, you know, using or drinking until, you know, I was in my 20s, you know, and it didn't become problematic till I was in my late 20s. And like for me, like I really sort of built an image from that. Like I, you know, eventually like I turned into kind of the party guy, and then I was the guy to go to get shit. Yeah. And then I was the guy that was still partying when everybody was done partying. And then I was the guy in rehab. You know what I mean? Like if this is the trajectory that drugs and alcohol took me on, and now I'm the guy that's sober and in recovery, you know, and going around to all my friends and making amends. So, you know, like it's been a journey for sure. But for me, like I've always, I don't know, like, what am I trying to say? I don't like the idea. I think that there's a lot of danger with identifying with a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to identify with my depression. Like the depression is a part of me, but it's not who I am.
Right.
And drugs and alcohol are a part of me, but they're not who I am. And even recovery, you know, is a part of me, but it's not necessarily who I am. Like I am somebody who is in recovery, but you know, I'm not my recovery. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's not the best way to look at it. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, man.
I built a pretty strong image in sobriety, and I don't know that it was, ultimately, I don't know that it was beneficial. You know, I don't know that it was in my favor, because I'm one of those people that have always felt like I needed to bring something to the table, right? Like even sitting here in the podcast studio right now, I feel like I have to be bringing something to the table. Like me just being here and sharing my experience isn't quite enough penance to be here. Like there has to be some type of value that I bring. And so even getting into recovery, it was kind of the same character defect, if you will, was I would go through and I would pick apart all these different personalities, and I'd see kind of, you know, where do I fit and how can I adapt that thing into my own self so that I can appear to be that type of person as well. Right. And it took me well into my late, you know, into my 40s before I was finally able. And I'm still just now being able to come around to accepting, you know, that I am enough. That's one of the things that my sponsor works with me on all the time, is like, fucking Will, you're enough. You're good enough. You're smart enough. You know, like,
have enough.
You're fucking enough. Like you're good. Like, you know, you're loved. Why don't you try accepting that for a little while? Right. And so I think that was also like ultimately part of my fall. Right. Because I was so attached to a certain image that, I didn't have willingness to change and adapt appropriately when it came to like the God stuff,
Right.
Like I built a pretty good atheistic image. I think, you know, like around here, I was kind of like the guy that didn't need a God.
Yeah.
Right. And I think everybody else could see it, but I couldn't. Like, you know, I see how that works for you, but it worked for me for a time until that moment came when I needed a power greater than myself to keep me from going insane.
Right.
And hence I went insane.
Yeah. You had to go insane in order to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And now you're maybe on the other side of it. You like to hope, right? A little more growth came and a little more surrender.
A lot more surrender.
A lot more surrender. Yeah. And some acceptance, I think. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy because as we're sitting here talking, I'm like, I never really like identified with anything. Like I've never like built my identity around a particular interest or hobby or, you know, like I've never, you're right. Actually, that was maybe the one thing, you know, for a minute I was trying to do some stand-up comedy and I've always been like the funny guy and for sure I've probably built an identity around that. Yeah.
What makes you think of that as fucking like defense?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, growing up, it was just a way to get attention. Like I can be funny and these people will give me the attention that I want. Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe I'm not getting enough to meet my sensitive needs.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, or it could be a defense mechanism. I mean, I think humor comes from a lot of places. For me, it comes from a place of wanting to connect, wanting to know, like feel validated, I think.
Yeah.
Like if they laugh, they like me. I know they like me if I can get them to laugh. So,
that's not necessarily, you know, wanting an identity, I don't think is always necessarily a bad thing. Right. I appreciate a strong, loyal, you know, like the image of the upright father, right? I appreciate that image. Like the guy that chooses the right action every time, you know, doesn't really, fall into a category with, you know, maybe a fashion style at all, but in the behavior sense, like the guy that the family leans on, you know, that kind of has some wisdom behind him, some health, you know, like has a healthy outlook on life. And that's more the image that I try to lean on now that I am a father and I have these responsibilities in my life and I respect that kind of person. But it took me a long time to really be able to surrender to, you know, a higher version of myself because I held on to a lot of secret behaviors for a long time, you know, and it wasn't until this last relapse that I saw, you know, for the listeners that don't know, you know, I gave up an 11-year chip for a 24-hour chip last year. And it wasn't until I had to come to a new surrender and getting sober again after being part of the podcast, after having an image of an atheist in sobriety, after, you know, all these things that I'd built my life around, that I could recognize surrender in a new way, that I was able to surrender to, you know, like, for instance, my wife. Like I've surrendered to being her partner forever in a faithful, upstanding relationship, right? Like I've been able to surrender that. I've been able to surrender to this notion that I do need something that's greater than me to help me get into these moments of sanity when the insane thinking is just fucking running me through, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and being okay with whether I portray a certain image or not, I do accept my imperfections today. And I think it's a lot healthier now than it was even a year ago.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, I can't speak for you, but I can speak from myself, which is like, if I'm in a place where I'm accepting my imperfections, then they're, you know, I'm doing pretty good today.
Yeah.
Because for me, the idea of perfection kept me sick for a long time,
Fuck. You
know, like, and it kept me from loving myself for a very long time. But I'm not perfect. Like I have you know, this and this wrong. And what about this? And, you know, I could name the whole list and it just kept me sick.
Yeah.
It kept me wanting to numb out, you know? And even in those instances where, you know, I thought that I loved myself, like I think that I've had moments, you know, where I've been fairly confident and comfortable in my own skin. But I think that, you know, a lot of that was based on, what I had hoped to be true, but wasn't actually true. Like I, you know, I had thought that maybe I was healthy and I had some healthy behavior and thinking around, food and my behavior there. But, you know, as it turns out, like as I get further down the road, like I see that's not the case. And for me, like I was building my identity around this somebody who is just kicking ass in recovery and losing a bunch of weight and, you know, getting a lot of time under his belt and hitting the gym on a constant basis and eating correctly and, you know, just everything. And then boom, something happened to shatter that, you know, I'd have a little relapse and then all of a sudden I'm just completely knocked down a peg or two and it's, and having a really hard time, like, believing myself, you know, again, yeah. after that happens. And so for me, like for my ego, for Cameron's ego, like it's best for me to just be Cameron today. You know, like I don't need to be Cameron, the alcoholic. I don't need to be Cameron, the athlete. I don't need to be Cameron, the guy in a 12-step program, or Cameron, the videographer, or Cameron, you know, the producer, or any of these. Like, I don't need to be any of those things. Like I can just be me, because it seems like every time that I get into those other identities, that the minute that I screw up or something happens to kind of rattle my belief in that, like I start questioning, like, you know, fall down this existentialism rabbit hole of who am I and why am I here? And, you know, like what's going on and really just get wrapped up in self-pity.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been an interesting time, you know, over the last little month, but yeah, I remember having those moments, you know, when I was out there using and drinking. And it's funny that you bring up comedy, because I totally, like when I was pursuing this, like I came to this conclusion at some point, you know, that I was going to actually like pursue this career in stand-up comedy. And what had happened is like I had started to tell myself, like, I need to be drunk. This is what comedians do. Like they, you know, they get a little drunk, they tell jokes on stage, you know, like, so like I'm more funny when I'm drunk. So why wouldn't I, you know, keep drinking?
Yeah.
And you know, the first time I ever did an open mic, I was hammered, just hammered drunk, you know, it didn't go well. It did not go well, you know, but,
you know, I would have liked to seen it.
Yeah. I have video of it somewhere. I'll have to show you. It's pretty bad. But, anyways, yeah, you know, and then I got sober and I tried to pursue that a little bit. Like I went back and here's the realization I had is I realized that yes, I could pursue this. And yes, I think it was possible, but it was going to take a lot of work and a lot of dedication. Like before I got sober and before recovery, I just had this belief that, you know, if I went to the club a couple of times, like I'm sure, like all of a sudden, you know, like I'll be a comedian.
Yeah.
And
it'll just happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, after I went through recovery and the blinders were lifted to so many things and the reality of life and that I'm not special and that if I want certain things, I'm going to have to do the same amount of work that anybody else would do to get those things. You know, I was able to see like, oh, like that is a possibility.
Yeah.
But I will have to dedicate X amount of time and X amount of energy into pursuing this thing to make it happen. And is that really what I want to do? You know? And at some point I just sort of accepted the fact like, you know what? Like, I don't think that's actually what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know? And I think shortly after that is when I went back to school. So yeah, man, it's, I don't know. Like, I think that there is kind of a danger with that. Obviously, like the danger of identifying with, or at least in my case, but I obviously the danger of identifying with the drugs and alcohol is it becomes that much harder to get rid of them, right? Like I didn't know how I was going to,
who am I without this?
Yeah. How am I going to like cope in the world? How am I going to be a comedian if I can't get drunk? Like I'm only funny when I'm drunk. You know what I mean? So I think that, like bringing that into your identity, is a surefire way to end up like a lot of those popular people who did a lot of those drugs did, you know, which is OD'd and died. So
yeah, the ego has an amazing way of making us liars and not liars, right? Like if I decide that I'm going to be this fucking negative person, you know, like let's say unhealthy in sexual relationships, right? Which was one of them for me. That went hand in hand with drug and alcohol use, right? I needed this image of putting notches in the gun, if you will, right? The more people that I was with sexually somehow fed that identity, right?
And then notches in the belt?
Yeah, whatever. Okay. However that expression goes, right? Like knocking them down, you know, then once that is gone, then who am I? Right. Mm-hmm. And now I can put these behaviors on myself, get rid of the drugs and alcohol, and then still have negative behaviors that are based in that lifestyle. Even though I don't want those things anymore, the ego is sitting there telling me, well, without these things, you are nothing, mm-hmm. right? Without these things, you are nothing. And that's kind of ultimately the disease for me in a nutshell is it's like an overbearing outside source that tries to keep me from being loved. And it will do anything it can to make sure that I end up alone and sad and drunk and dead. Right. And so how do we fucking flip that? Right. Like, how do we know when we're in that shit? And it's like such a fucking elusive thing, man, because like I can get too virtuous at the same time, right? I'm so good at doing the wrong thing with the best of intentions. Just fucking everything up and not meaning to. Right?
Well, and I think that through the work, right? Like through, being of service, through helping other people, through being a sponsor or, a mentor of some sort to people who have been through what it is you're going through, and still being humble enough to be a sponsee or be somebody who still needs to ask questions, who is still like learning and still teachable. I think that we're able to at least get to a point where we feel right-sized, right? Because that's my thing. It's like, I always feel like I'm king shit or I'm jack shit.
Yeah.
Right. Like I never feel like I'm just me.
Yeah.
Like the exact right proportion of Cameron, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that the only time that I have ever seemed to get any sort of peace around that idea, depends on how spiritually fit I seem to be as a result of, being plugged in and working a program. Like it seems, it's funny to me too, because the addict in me will always tell me that's too much work. That the 12-step thing is too much work. Yeah. Like, dude, that's too much work. Like, let's go back to being miserable.
Yeah.
Like, let's go back to doing nothing. And it's like,
I do.
Do you remember how hard that was? Like, that's actually hard. Like, that's hard. The 12-step thing is, it requires some action, but it's not actually hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's doing nothing. It's hard.
It is. You know, over the last year, I've spent so much time really, really dialing in and focusing in on how certain things make me feel. Okay, and like I get a lot of anxiety now. You know, I've dropped several of my medications that I was on, and you know, I get these levels of anxiety, and I think it's a human condition. I don't think I'm special to this, but what I've done is I've started taking a moment of panic, and I've watched the chemical reaction happen inside of me. And so it's been really interesting because of what you're talking about. I'll try to bring it back around to that. Is, you know, I get a cortisol hit or whatever, right? And I feel that release in my brain. And then it flows through my body, raises my heart rate, right? I get the physical reaction. All of the imaginary evils start running through my mind, right? All the things that I think are going to go wrong, that sense of impending doom. And I watch it as it affects my body and my mind. And I start kicking out the imaginary shit, the things that there's no way that it's going to happen. You know, all the things that I've already proven, you know, right. You're going to run out of money. You're going to end up homeless. Your kids are going to get sick. You know, I mean, just insert fear here, right? Whatever it is. And what I found is that as I've been doing this stuff and really trying to dial it in, is that all of my fears come from a place of inconvenience, right? Like it's always boils down to how inconvenient is this going to make in my life? Right. So let's say, because I'm a business owner, you know, I've solely relied on my self-employment for financial support for a couple of years now for my family. And, I'll go through and, you know, I'll get a phone call and the first thing that'll happen is that cortisol hit, boom, I'll go into this fucking state of anxiety, right? I don't even know what's on the other end yet. You know, a lot of this stuff happens kind of quick. And I'll go through and it always boils down to how inconvenient is this going to make it for me? How much extra work do I have to do? So, you know, when I'm hit with this identity crisis of like, you know, I no longer want to be an atheist, right? I no longer want to identify as self-reliant. I get a lot of fear around that, right? Like this fear pops up, the chemical reaction happens. And I have to ask myself, like, how much extra work am I going to have to do to not identify with that anymore, right? And then the fear is all based around this fucking selfish notion of how much work do I need to do? And the only way that I can get out of it is by being of service to other people, right? Like I have to physically make myself, it's not a path of like, this is going to be easier or not. It's like, it's a must. Like if I want to get out of anxiety, I have to go and be in service of other people. And I find that it's really not that inconvenient, right? And the funny thing of it is too, is like, I've sat on the couch and done nothing.
Right.
I've been the guy that didn't do a fucking thing and it was more painful than the fear of going out and doing something.
Right, right, right.
But it'll still pop up and fucking, I'll get squirrely. That thing will just start running through my mind. And it's been kind of neat because I no longer want to attach to any certain identity, right? Like I don't want to be attached to the outcome of what it is. I just want to have good behaviors in my life because that's what I know pays off.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And what people think of it, it is, you know, me starting to post, this spiritual journey that I'm on and starting to say, you know, that I'm working with God and that I become a person of prayer and all that stuff. Like it's been scary for me because I'm afraid of the judgment that's going to come around from that. Mm-hmm. And obviously there hasn't been any,
right.
You know? And it was the same thing with identifying with everything else, you know? And I think that's the point is like, I get to this point, this place where my ego tries to convince me that no matter what identity I take on, I'm going to end up needing that ego to rely on to get me through life. Right. Because I'm never going to be good enough kind of thing. And I don't know.
It seems to come down to that. And it's funny because when you were talking about this idea that of being inconvenienced, like I totally identified with what you were saying, because I feel like the same thing happens to me, at work constantly. constantly. Like anytime anybody comes to me for anything,
you get that hit, right?
Yeah. Like your body. There's a little bit of anxiety, and then it's like, wait, what do you want me to do? Like, mind you, these people are simply asking me to do my job.
Yeah.
Right. But it's like, oh, like, and really, like, what it is more than inconvenience, like, it's discomfort, right? Like, oh, yeah. Well, then if you want me to do this, then I won't have time for that. And then how will I manage that? And then
what about my couch?
Yeah. What about what exactly? Like it's all like in an attempt to get back to nothing.
Yeah.
You know, like at which point do I get to do nothing?
Yeah. And you've been there, right? And it sucks.
Yeah.
That's what's so crazy about it. That's why it's insane.
Right.
That's why it's completely insane.
The nothing is never what we think it's going to be. It's an idea, right? Yeah. It's an idea that if I have all this stuff off of my plate and I'm able to do nothing, then I'll feel peaceful and internal bliss.
Be happy.
And happiness. And it never seems to be that way. Now, that's not to say that I don't feel happiness and internal bliss, but the only times that I feel like I'm okay with that are times that have been designated to feel that way, right? Like I'm going to go sit on the couch and watch a movie with my family, you know, like then I can feel that happiness and bliss. But like anytime that I'm like, man, I can't wait to get done with this shit so I can watch a program.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I end up feeling horrible about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the disease, man. It's alive and well.
It is. It is very alive and very well within me. And I'm very grateful to have a program that gives me the ability to, you know, process through some of this stuff and you know, someone to talk to and some way to put on paper and enough experience to go through and recognize some of the lies when they pop up, mm-hmm. right? Give me mm-hmm. some defense.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to get drunk, man.
Well, I mean, it's beyond that, because I know what a drink will do. Like I kind of want to get drunk, but I know what that'll do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Like I don't know, man. Like I'm really glad you brought it back to service. Cause that's a good thing for me to remember. Like this is why we do service. Like this, I got to get out of my head, you know, and help somebody, like, or see if I can be of help or be willing to help, you know, because it seems to be the one thing that that I can do and then later go sit on the couch and feel okay about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. Well,
yeah.
You know, I think that this topic has been great. I really want to have everybody listen to this amazing war story from Dave.
Yeah, Dave.
Dave's quite a guy, as you guys probably know, if you're fans of the Dopey podcast. He was nice enough to get with me and share his story, and I think you guys are really going to get a lot out of it. So without further ado, here is Dave's war story.
All right. I didn't think I was an addict. Like being an addict was not on my radar for a long, long, long time. I grew up in a very sort of as bucolic a middle class scene in Manhattan as somebody could grow up in. I grew up in public housing. My parents were both public school teachers. I went to, I mean, not to be braggy, but probably the best school in New York City that was free. 50 kids got in out of 10,000. And it was like a pilot school that never existed. Like in order for gifted kids to get that kind of experience, and I got in I'd say 1978, and I graduated in 1992. So like my whole childhood was shaped by this school that I went to and being supposedly gifted. And my gifts probably started to erode when I was like 6 or 7. And by the time I was 12 or 13, they were asking me to leave the gifted school, of which I said, no, I will not leave the gifted school because I don't want to go to public school where I grew up because it seemed scary to me. And I think my first addiction was some sort of codependency on my friends. in the school. Like I had a crew of friends and I was enmeshed and I'm still enmeshed with those guys. You know, I'm 48, I'm going to be 49 at the end of the month. And I'm still enmeshed with some of the same people I was enmeshed with at 4 and 10 and 17. And I think that enmeshment kind of staved off alcoholism and drug addiction for many years until the first time I was without them. I was at a summer camp. I was a waiter at a summer camp, and I even brought a couple of them with me. And we were so disenfranchised by the world there that my alcoholism showed up and I was lonely and I was uncomfortable in my skin and I was miserable and I felt fear and some kind of depression, not clinical depression, anxiety. I remember I would lie on a hill and stare at the sky and listen to Abbey Road. I was like 15 or 16 and I hadn't had that part of me. And at the end of the summer, and I was a horrible waiter too. It was a horrible experience. It's probably the most uncomfortable I had ever been. And at the end of the summer, the kitchen staff, who were all English, had a party. And I have a memory of showing up at the party. And maybe I have a memory of drinking my first screwdriver, but I think I drank 16 screwdrivers. I just kept drinking them straight, you know, bang, 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 bang. Never had a drink before. And I blacked out, projectile vomited all night. People had to make sure I didn't die. And I remember the next day on the bus coming back, kind of feeling cool that I was sick, kind of feeling like this is something, you know, because I grew up so, you know, whatever the Jewish equivalent of Leave It to Beaver was. So I kind of had that feeling of I wanted to be that. I want to go through something. I want to be, you know, a little bit broken. You know, I like that idea, but alcohol didn't suit me. And I tried drinking at school dances and I would get sick every time. I would throw up, I would get uncomfortable, and I found weed by the end of high school. But I wasn't in a situation to become a pothead. My life was too good for my drug addiction to really kick in. So like, whatever, I smoked weed here and there and I went to college. And when I got to college, I had the exact same experience as at that summer camp where I felt totally disenfranchised and alone. And I was a musician. I played harmonica and I loved the Beatles and I loved, again, that idea of being broken, of all those things, like being smart and being broken. And what did the Beatles do? And kind of that beatnik idea and all that shit started really swirling around in my head. And it came to a head smoking weed and playing music. And I remember I smoked weed in college and I didn't stop. You know, I was like, I like this identity. It dealt with my neuroses. It dealt with my anxiety. It gave me, I loved being a stoner. It was like, I loved Scooby-Doo growing up and I kind of felt like some sort of version of Shaggy. And I kind of felt like all I had to care about was weed. And I really treated it like heroin. Like when I smoked every day, we started selling it almost immediately. When I didn't have it, I would go seek it out. If I didn't have money, I would find someone to give it to me. I treated it like a physical addiction within the first year. And at the same time, I was doing psychedelics. I would do anything I got, which at that point was psychedelics, mushrooms, LSD. I would get pills. I didn't even know what they were, but I would take them. I didn't really care. I wound up getting kicked out of school because of selling weed. I got busted. But I had applied to transfer before I got busted and I got accepted to transfer. So I transferred colleges as I got suspended from the first one and no one ever found out. And that was like a great moment of getting away with it. You know, like we look back and we see these moments where maybe if I had gotten busted there, this wouldn't have happened. And that was one of those things. And I wound up going to art school in Westchester, New York, a school called SUNY Purchase, which was a notorious drug school. And I loved it. my first school was called Ithaca College, and it was like a frat school. It was like you were either a frat guy or a hippie or an alternative guy. And I was none of those things. So I felt very out of it. At Purchase, basically you're just a drug addict. I was a drug addict, and I was like, this is the best. Like, and it just suited me. And immediately, like, we're going and buying sheets of acid in Central Park and selling them at Purchase, and it's paying for everything at Purchase. And it was great. And, you know, I was tripping a couple times a week, probably. I was smoking pot every day. And then one of my roommate's friends, who was a kind of a professional rock and roll musician, showed up at our dorm with heroin, and I tried it and I liked it, but it was too intense. And I was like, I'm going to stick with smoking weed. I still loved the identity of it. And as I moved forward in my life, I would try anything that came my way. I loved ecstasy. I wound up doing coke, but I didn't like coke, but if it showed up, I would do it. I rarely drank. And I graduated school within 4 years. And I moved to Manhattan, and I started taking weird jobs. And I grew up, like I told you, in public housing, and it was really, really, really affordable. And my mother, anybody who lives there, you try to get your kids to live there. And my mother put me on the list for an apartment when I was 11, and my name came up when I was 22. And I got a place. It was $300 a month on 24th Street and 8th Avenue. Big studio with an eat-in kitchen and a changing area. And I remember when I got that place, man, I was so excited. I remember what the fresh paint smelled like. I remember the spring on that street and how the trees were bursting with pink flowers. And I had hope in my heart for a good life. And I didn't have to make much money, and I did what I wanted. And it was like in the early mid 90s in New York City. There were flea markets in Chelsea, and life was good. And around that time, I started dabbling in TV production. I had a friend of mine from college move in, and he didn't have to pay rent. All he had to do was make sure we had drugs. He started delivering weed. He started finding coke. And he loved coke. He would come home with coke. And then I think I stumbled onto one of these drug delivery services, which were rare back then. And it was called Indulge. And they had a business card of like a white silhouetted man with a top hat, and it said Indulge. I can really see it very clearly in my head. And I was working for TV production, and I went on a job to Michigan. And when I came home, there were a bunch of kids from my college and the guy who had moved in with me, my friend Todd. And they were all buying coke from the Indulge guy, this kid named Kevin, who was like 16. And he's selling like hundreds and maybe $1,000 in coke in my apartment. And I had just come home from this trip, and I was like, dude, if you're going to make all this money in my apartment, what are you going to give me? And he takes out two bags of heroin, and he throws it on my coffee table. And I was like, great. You know, it's like I won this round. You know what I mean? Like I'm the manipulative mastermind. And everyone left, and me and Todd did a bunch of coke, and then we sniffed the two bags of heroin, and it hit me in a different way. And it really made me feel exactly the way I had always wanted to, where it was kind of like weed, but more, where I could care less. Like all I wanted to be was a person who said, I don't give a fuck and mean it, because all I had ever done is given way more than a fuck. And when I did heroin, I kind of actually didn't give a fuck, and I really liked it. And my career developed, and I wound up getting on air for this TV company in Manhattan. And I wound up getting a show, a music magazine show that I was developing myself. It was a really amazing situation. And I got signed to a 3-year contract, which, you know, by today's standards wasn't that much money, but back then for a 24-year-old kid who's paying $300 a month, it felt like, you know, I was rich. And my heroin addiction really, really kicked in then. And I started using every day. I remember making the decision I was going to use every day. It was after years of being like, I'll use on Wednesday, and I'll use on Saturday, and then I'll use on Sunday, and then maybe Monday, and then I got this contract, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to use every day, and I embraced it. And I started reading, you know, I was like one of these people that read Burroughs and I read Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and all that stuff. And I felt this grandiosity. I felt like I was one of these guys, you know what I mean? I felt like I could read William Burroughs and that's like my life, you know, so stupid looking back on it. And like everything was kind of working out except that the heroin wasn't hitting me the same way. And I was running out of money, even though I was making $100,000 a year and paying $300 a month, like the math wasn't working out. And I would start, I was doing this music show where I'd interview people like Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead or KRS-One or the Flaming Lips or all these bands that I loved. I loved this situation. And every interview I did high, you know, every interview was worse than the one before. Like I did no research. It was a travesty of a dream that I had. You know, my dream did not come true. Instead, I wound up, you know, I think the dealers ran out on me more than I ran out of money at first, and I didn't have a secondary source. But then I ran out of money, and I got on methadone. And then I hated being on methadone. It just kept descending until I had to check into detox, and I didn't tell the production company. I had the choice of telling the production company or my parents, and I chose to tell my parents, and the production company fired me immediately because I was in breach of contract. And from there, my life just free-falled. You know, I got a couple more good jobs, but really for 12 years, it was just rehab after rehab, detox after detox. I had started shooting up. I had gone from methadone clinic to methadone clinic. I just was not functioning. And I wound up in Florida in long-term treatment. I didn't want to get sober. I wound up staying there for almost a year. Again, never getting sober, wound up smoking weed in the halfway house, like just living this bullshit sort of existence. And I moved to California with that guy, Todd. He lived there. They had made a deal that if I had moved in with them, we weren't to do heroin. It was Todd and my friend Jeremy, who I had also grown up with, and we had all done a bunch of heroin in Manhattan. And the deal was I had just gotten out of rehab, so they're not to do heroin. But they were still smoking pot. And Jeremy didn't realize that Todd had started using meth, crystal meth. And when I got there, Todd was like 2 weeks into his first crystal meth run. And I was like, I'll do that too. Like, who cares? You know? And I'm just like, so I'm smoking meth with Todd as soon as I get there. And I knew that I didn't like uppers. I knew that I hated uppers. So as soon as I'm like a week into meth, I'm like, let's go to Mexico and get pills. And from there, I wound up on heroin in Los Angeles. And I had a girlfriend that I lived with, and I got on methadone there. And that's kind of like every bottom is like the new bottom. And the bottom in L.A. was I was on 150 milligrams of methadone. I didn't work for probably 5-6 years. My girlfriend took care of me. I lived in Echo Park like a bum with a girlfriend. And because I was never a heroin addict that would survive on my own. I was like a very bougie heroin addict. I often joke, like if I didn't have cable TV, I would have probably gotten sober. Like I just didn't want that fucking life. I wanted to like eat. I would eat an Entenmann's cake for breakfast and an Entenmann's cake for dinner. I was a big fat junkie. I would watch Lost over and over again, remarking on how lost I was. And then like I got a phone call from my mom. And she had been diagnosed with leukemia, and she was in New York, and I was like, fuck. And I had the first inkling that I needed to change my life. So I said, I got to go home. You know, I got to go back east, and I got to get off methadone because I'm not going to let my mother die. Not that I was so close with my mother, but I'm not going to let my mother die of leukemia while I'm a big fat junkie methadone addict in Los Angeles. I can't live with that, you know? And that was the first time in my life I was like, I can't live with this. And I got off methadone a milligram at a time in a blind taper, which was amazing. Just the greatest thing in the world to get off of. And I went back east, and me and my girlfriend moved to Vermont. And I wound up back in Manhattan, and my mother wound up dying. And when I got back to Manhattan, I got a job at Katz's Deli, where I had worked when I was in high school. And I was like, I can't believe this is my life. But still, my life was better and more productive than it had been in a long time. And I wound up hooking up with this woman, and she's incredibly beautiful, and I felt incredibly fortunate. And then within like 3 months, she was pregnant. And my mother had just died, and I had just got this woman pregnant. And I wasn't doing, I was smoking weed. I was not doing anything else in terms of drugs. But as soon as she got pregnant, and I met her actually through that same guy, Todd, who lived in my apartment, who I did meth with. And I lived in LA with. And I met this woman, her name is Linda, through him. And she was pregnant, and then Todd started showing up with heroin, and I was like, all right. And I relapsed on heroin with Todd in the pregnancy. I would go to live birth classes with Lynn, and my pockets were full of Xanax and Klonopin and heroin, and I was keeping my habit a secret, and it was the new bottom, and we had a baby, and I was using. And she was a little baby, and I was using, I was shooting up in the other room in our apartment, and Linda caught me, and she said, you got to go. And I left, and she moved out. She moved to Long Island with our baby, and I moved to Manhattan again, and I visited the baby 2 days a week, and my heroin addiction exploded. And, I started using probably around $300 a day for years, you know, and I was lost, and I wound up my father. The only way I was allowed to see my daughter is if my father drove me. And that was our custody agreement, that I could visit 2 days a week with my father. And I was pathetic, you know, I was as pathetic as you could be. And I remember I went out one night, and I went drinking. I don't even know. Like, I was trying to pick up a girl in a bar or something. I went out drinking. I didn't pick anybody up. I'm walking home from the bar. I think I'm on my phone walking home from the bar, and I literally walk into a wall. I break my nose. I get a black eye from walking into the wall, and I'm like, I got to go get help. And I checked into a rehab, and I could not bear to not be able to visit my kid without my dad. It was just too, just painful and demoralizing. And I wound up signing an agreement with Linda that once I could show 365 days without any drugs in my system, I could get 2 days a week to visit Nora by myself. And then once the year was done, once I had a few months, I could visit Nora on Long Island by myself. And after I had the year, Nora could come into the city and stay with me for 2 days a week. And I did it. I got 365 days clean. I think I drank a few times, cause I knew that wouldn't come up in the hair test. And I got custody, and all I wanted was to put my actual family back together. But it didn't happen. You know, I wasn't in sobriety. I wasn't in recovery. You know, I was just trying to get by, really. And I wound up relapsing on weed, and I still had custody every, you know, 2 days a week. And I was smoking pot every day. And then I started dating somebody who had pills. And so I would smoke pot and take pills once or twice a week. All I wanted to do was put the family back together. And Linda eventually said, all right, we can go on vacation. And we went on vacation to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And she would bring Xanax to help her sleep. And I stole the Xanax. And she like lost her mind. And she's like, we're not getting back together. And she's like, in fact, you're going to need to get another 365 days before we get the baby, before I get custody again. And that's when I went to my first, I'd been to 12-step meetings. I just hadn't gone for the right reasons, I don't think. And it's funny, I just wasted 20 minutes on my using. I always do this. I never get to the good part fast enough. I'm so much more entertained by the bad part. I wound up getting into 12-step and I heard someone say, rarely have we seen anyone thoroughly follow the path and not achieve these results. And I did it. I was all in, and it worked. You know what I mean? Like, within a few months, we actually started making this podcast, and within a few more months, Linda agreed to get back together. And, within the year I moved out to Long Island with her and Nora. And then within the next few years, we had another baby and we bought a house, and that's basically my story. You know, I still go to meetings. My life is not perfect. I'm sober almost 8 years in August, and that's my story. You know, I do everything I can do. You know, I talk to multiple addicts and alcoholics every day. I work a program. I do 12-step work. I have sponsees. I have a sponsor that I talk to, you know, fairly regularly. And my life is mostly really good. And that's my story.
Awesome. Yeah. There it is, man.
I get so much out of those. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for sharing your story. What did you think of Dave's story,
man? Yeah, I appreciate it, you know, like... That young ego, man, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what? What I really appreciate about these war stories, and something I miss since we haven't done these for a minute, is just hearing like how different things are for people, yeah, like regionally. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Dave's a guy that grew up in New York, Jewish. And like he said, he went to this school,
yeah,
and he built his identity around this school. And then eventually
that whole thing.
Yeah. Like he wasn't really, up to the standards, I guess, of said school. And so, then his journey kind of had him all over the place, yeah, you know? So it's interesting because it's not something you might hear about, you know, here locally in Utah.
Yeah.
And so I like that because what we then hear is how much we're all the same.
Yeah.
Right. Is he had this sort of discomfort in him his whole life, and never felt really like he fit in or like he was the same or,
right,
comfortable in his own skin. And I'm like, yeah.
Place to place. Didn't matter where he went. There he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That whole thing, you know, and like I could always identify with anybody that likes to do the drugs they like, but will also do the drugs that they don't like if somebody else is bringing those drugs.
Right.
You know, do plenty of somebody else's drugs. And, you know, the part where it was pretty obvious, you know, like if you're going to be using my fucking apartment, like what am I going to get? Here, you get to destroy yourself along with us. That's what you get. Right.
Yeah.
And looking at that as a good thing.
Yeah. I was going to say, and here's the thing is like being looking at that and going, all right.
Yeah. I've arrived.
Yeah.
That's my identity. Of course you're going to give me your dope because mm-hmm. that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, oh yeah, that is who I am. A person that doesn't respect themselves or anybody else.
Yeah.
And ultimately like that's ended up what it was being, right? Like this selfish, you know, me kind of, give me what you got so I can, and it's all under false pretense. Right. And like, we do care about the people that we're out there with, but we don't care about them more than we care about ourselves and our dope.
Oh, right. Like, yeah. I mean, I really, you know, he talked about how he spent 20 minutes on, you know, how it was and not enough time on how it is now. But I really appreciated the conversation Dave and I were able to have, you know, off camera. Like once we, kind of wrap that part of it, you know, to hear him talk about his life now and recovery. And I asked him some questions about the podcast and just how, you know, how that started and why, and, you know, it seems like a lot of people get a lot from Dave and his story and what he's done with the podcast. And I think that, being able to kind of go through what it is we go through and then turn it into something now where, you know, he gives his time.
Yeah.
And takes time away from his family. And from his career to, you know, produce this podcast and look at what, you know, like what it's done for people. Yeah. And it's brought so many people together. And what I really appreciate about it is that it brings together people who are usually in the spotlight, right? Like we see celebrities and we see musicians and things where all these people that we're able to look at and say, wow, like even you
yeah.
had the same thing that I had struggled with and dealt with. And, yeah, I mean, you know, nobody's immune.
Yeah.
The disease knows no bounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just really grateful. I hope you guys got something from that. That was really amazing.
So, yeah, I always do.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot, man. Well, Willie, what'd you think, man?
I'm a little shaky. You know, I feel a little rusty over here. But, you know, I'm here. We've had a lot of requests. You know, people wondering where we're at, what you're doing, what's going on.
You guys coming back.
And that feels pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, who, me?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I ain't got nothing. I'm just me.
Yeah. You know, like I know what with where I've been in the last year and a half has just been in this sort of descent into self-loathing and self-pity, you mm-hmm. know, and a lot of isolation even, you know. And it's been quite the journey to get to where it hurt enough, you know, to where it was bad enough that it was like, dude, I mean, what's going on, you know? And I feel blessed that I at least have the ability to know people who I can lean on and talk to and get pointed towards a solution, you know? Today I feel pretty good.
You know?
I've definitely, listen, like one thing that we've talked about before is that we've never promised to have all the answers, right?
Right.
Like we're just here to share our experience and we've had some. Yeah. And it's a good thing because that's all I got.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like Fausto, you know, like he always says, like our stories become our power, our superpower.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's been therapeutic. You know, we didn't, like we said at the beginning of the show, we didn't realize how much you guys, you know, the listeners were helping us. And it's funny how that goes, you know, around, I would say September of 2022, I took a pain pill and I didn't tell anybody. And over the next few months, I spiraled into a complete relapse into narcotics, you know, lost my dad and like had a new awakening. I had to get sober all over again. And, you know, coming out of the tails of that, just like it, you know, and I think we'll share on it more and more as the show goes on and we bring new episodes. The people that have given us their stories for the show have been, a cornerstone of my recovery for the last several years that we've been doing the podcast. You know, I get so much hope, information and direction from everybody else's stories, and to come in here and get to sit down and identify with those people as one person to another and one alcoholic to another has been immense, you know? And I think mm-hmm. that's why we've continued to talk about coming back and, you know, not giving up, not closing the doors on the studio. And regardless of what we went through over the last year, you know, finding that we do bring value, that people do appreciate us, you know, that's a massive win for, you know, some people with some low self-esteems like our own, you know, and I'm excited to come in and share because, you know, a lot of you longtime listeners have watched me go from atheism to agnosticism to somewhat believing, you know, from overweight to fit to overweight to fit to, you know, in and out to to, you know, faithful husband to fucking sick boyfriend, like just up and down, you know, you guys have walked through me with all this stuff. And I don't plan on not sharing any of that stuff, because I do think that based on what you guys have told us, you're getting something out of our vulnerability, and, right. and that makes it all worth it, getting out here and taking our shirts off, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. I've been saying that from episode one. You want to get vulnerable? You take your shirt off.
Yeah. And we kind of are, you know, come out here and share some things that are kind of embarrassing. You know, it's not easy to say, you know, I had 11 years of sobriety and I gave that up for a pain pill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, that could have went one or two ways. You know, it could have took me to my grave, or it could have took me to a place of humility that I needed to be to. And thank God it took me to the place of humility, and, you know, pray that I never get back to the point where I think I got this.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm just glad today, you know, I'm sober. I seem to have a good idea of how to get through the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's all I need.
Yeah.
That and a power greater than myself and you people, like,
yeah,
probably make it today.
Yeah. So cool.
Well, all right, man. Do you remember how to do this part? The sign off?
I think so. With that.
Remember, you are worth the work.
We'll see you on the other side.